Okay, we have a limited amount of time and a topic. I might as well have chosen the Bible or something in 45 minutes because this is not something that we're going to get to the end of. So, right off the bat, I need someone with excellent penmanship that is a reasonably good speller. I cannot do either of those things. The doctorate student in the back, come forward. You should come and sit in that chair right there.
He could be the man of wife.
Until I tell you to get up. Will there be someone there?
You have to do obeisance?
I want one person to be tasked to make sure that she's doing it right. Not everyone, because I want you to focus on me. So one person, make sure she's spelling everything right. Okay?
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
I wanted to start tonight with, I didn't want to patronize, so I wanted to go right into stereotypes. I want to go into the stereotypes of why people are homeless. So, slowly, clearly, we're going to call them out, and my speller here is going to write them clearly on the board here. Okay? So.
Let's go mental illness.
Yeah. Come on,
stereotypes.
Don't work hard enough.
Yes.
Writing.
Mostly men.
It, mostly.
Yeah, mostly.
They're man.
They're male.
They're male.
Okay.
The stereotype.
You're running with the wrong hand.
Oh yeah, they're
wrong hand. Okay, good. Good.
Right. Uh-huh, you got it.
There were a bunch that came at once. Have I missed one?
Drugs.
Drugs. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're drunks and they're.
You could add fiend. Right. That's stereotypical, right?
Fiend.
Yeah, drug fiend.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Not very educated.
Ah.
They have a choice.
You got it.
There you go, mm-hmm. Choice.
Scammers.
One I encounter a lot. Anything else?
You said it was because they were boys.
Sounds like a congressman.
Then it's a lifestyle.
A lifestyle choice?
You chose it, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll put that
looking for a handout.
What do we hear some cliches around that? I mean, some of these things up here. I've often heard, like, you give a man a fish and he eats for a day, and you teach a man a fish and he eats for a lifetime. I mean, these things that people, those who don't work don't eat, things like that. These little, like, things that we get going for ourselves that, kind of allow us just to kind of say that it's some sort of moral failing right off the bat. Is there any other ones that we could think of?
I'm going to put moral failing up there.
Moral failing.
It's their fault.
I have to put, I've encountered this down in downtown Seattle because they don't know Jesus. I've encountered it. Yes.
Have said
do I
that
have to
Seattle?
Write that?
It's a stereotype, and
dang
I don't like
it.
You to write it.
Okay.
It's,
wow.
It's with a J.
You're home.
And under male, you might put male adults.
Yeah.
That's part of the stereotype, is thinking that it's mostly.
Oh,
males.
Yeah.
There we go.
Well.
Yep, that's.
Okay, I think you could sit down for a few. Okay. Let's talk about some of these. See if we can, like, collectively kind of maybe debunk some of these right out the bat. Lazy. Who believes that? That they're just lazy? That someone is... And then you'd have... I'm going to ask you to back it up, but... No one? Okay. So, a lot of people you're going to encounter... will say that, okay, well, people are homeless because they don't have a job and they're not getting an income and they just aren't willing to work. What do we kind of know?
Go ahead, how about criminal?
A criminal record is a, well, that's, mm-hmm. That might put that on a list later.
Okay.
We have a lot of things up here that, would you say that you know at least one person who would believe something on this in your life?
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Oh, gosh.
Maybe two people?
Why get a job? Why go through all that when you can make $11 an hour?
Yeah, you hear that someone panhandling makes $70,000 a year or something like that, and you know they put a suit on later or whatever. Okay, let's start at the top. Moral failings. What's wrong with that?
It's a societal failing.
There's a lot of rich people with moral failings.
Yeah.
We all have moral failings.
Uh-huh. What are some other things?
I said it's a societal failing that we're letting these people slip through the cracks.
I totally agree with that. But what about a person? What kind of moral failings would lead to someone being disenfranchised and homeless? Can we think of any?
They left their family.
They left their family? Okay.
There's a lot of GLBT youth.
That's one I'm going to throw into actual causes of homelessness in Seattle, but I'm glad you brought it up. Right.
See that as a moral
yeah. Exactly. I encounter a lot of transgendered people and that in some stage of homelessness in downtown Seattle, and there's really not a whole lot of support for people in transition, but that's a whole other session, I think. Who said mental illness right off the bat? Is that you, Christian?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is actually a huge reason why people fall into the category of chronically homeless. I guess I should tell you a little bit about what I want to do here today. Is not only do I want to kind of get a better handle on why people are homeless. There's a lot of things I'm not going to talk about today. I'm not going to talk about children. I'm not going to really talk about families. I'm not going to talk about the situationally homeless and kind of the down and outs, or people who are choosing some sort of vagabond lifestyle. I'm talking about the chronically homeless, the ones that are receiving most of the aid, and the ones that you're encountering mostly in the downtown areas of major cities. I've been doing this for 10 years, first in supportive housing and then as a mental health case manager. Supportive housing is this idea that we're going to take a human being that is in the midst of whatever they're doing, whether they're a full-blown drug addict, whether they're not taking meds for their mental illness, whether they're suffering from some sort of crippling disability. Yeah?
Do you include the teens in that?
I don't have a lot of experience working with teens. I feel like I could, but I don't want to speak to that because I'm not an expert in any of this. I just have a lot of experience working with a certain subset of people. So,
you take them and give them a home?
Yes, we would take them and just put them into housing, and this would be a concept called Housing First, which is most of the big cities in America have gone to this model. They've gotten away from shelters and tent cities and whatnot, and we're just going to put a person in a house and kind of help them be successful in that environment. And I started as a residential counselor in that environment, helping people maintain housing.
So that was like a group home where you put like four people that were homeless in a four-bedroom house? Or
similar. What it was 190 units in a renovated hotel in downtown Seattle. The mezzanine level was a 200-bed shelter and 190 apartments above it. And I started on a swing shift with one other person trying to help 190 people maintain housing. So I learned a lot really quickly. And then from there, I went on to mental health case management for trying to bring a next level of stability for benefits and whatnot to be able to keep people stable in society. And I was talking to someone earlier. My job was basically to remain calm all the time because everyone else is freaking out. The hospital is calling you freaking out. The police are freaking out. Everyone's freaking out. So my job is to kind of be like the Hindu cow, just kind of, yeah. It's cool. Yeah. So male adults. Why male adults? Why is that up there? What's wrong with that statement?
We're the ones that are always, you always see on the street corners with the signs.
It's a lot of them, yeah.
Well, just that there's so many women and children
mm-hmm.
who are also homeless.
Why do you think that we see a lot of men on the streets and not women?
I think, sorry.
Go ahead.
I just think women are much more hidden about their homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
In the back there.
I was wondering if women sometimes were just caught in the prostitution kind of thing, too, and that's why they were not on the street because their pimps were keeping them off the street.
In my experience, it's easier for a woman to find some sort of relationship that will keep them off the street. I'm not saying it's a healthy relationship, but they do have something to offer, as you alluded to, and this keeps them off the street. I worked with a lot of prostitutes in downtown Seattle, and they do not have an easy life. They might have a place to sleep at night, but it is not a stable in place. But you'll mainly see men in shelters.
I think that more people are willing to let a down on their luck woman, you know, couch surf for a period of time or whatever, than you are to take a unknown male into your house just because of the, you know, sexual assault and things like that, the potential size and power and everything. So I think that there's probably less hospitality offered to men.
That very few of my clients that were women actually slept outside. They did have some place to go. Some didn't abuse them, I could say that. But generally, most of the people that you see using the resources are men. But we're split about 50-50, you know. So there is just as many homeless or marginally housed women out there. The men tend to be more photogenic. The biggie, alcohol, drunks, drug addicts. What's wrong with this?
I just wanted to add one because it's the veterans as well.
Yeah, that's we'll throw that in. The we're going to do another list, so she's not done yet. What's wrong with the idea that alcohol, drunks, drug addicts?
There's a strong correlation between drugs and alcohol and mental illness.
Mm-hmm. I had a client, we'll call her Deborah, who is a schizophrenic, and she would hear audio hallucinations of her grandmother talking about her genitalia. Now, I don't know about your grandmother, but I don't want my grandmother talking about my private parts. But this is what she heard, and you know what helped her? Smoking crack. So getting her on meds, meds take work. There's a lot of levels there. You have to constantly be adjusting things. It takes a lot of work for someone to maintain meds. If they get some relief from smoking crack cocaine and it feels really good and they don't hear their grandmother talking about their genitalia, who wants to try the meds that, you know, take a lot of work, make you feel lethargic? Some make you gain weight, or who wants to smoke crack? Yeah. So a lot of people end up self-medicating a lot of their, whether it's PTSD, secondary trauma, just negative coping skills, dealing with some sort of their highs and lows. I mean, a lot of people are in this category of homeless and mentally ill. Turn to drugs and or alcohol to alleviate some of the suffering. Not to mention that we as a society have kind of collectively seen some of the abuse of some of this as an illness. So we wouldn't get, you know, oh, damn it, Becky, and your lupus, you know, or something. Like, we can't get mad at you for that, you know, but we'll throw moral failings at anyone who is seen abusing drugs and or alcohol.
There's also a huge outbreak of heroin addicts that are wealthy, have been on prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of addicts who are not on the streets.
Yeah. I mean, what is the most abused subset of drugs in America is prescriptions.
Yeah, Xanax. And
yeah. Heroin. Yeah. So, I mean, I've heard a definition of a drug addict is someone who does a drug that you don't and you don't like it. You know, it's a As a little aside, you might notice my t-shirt. We're going to deal with some heavy stuff. If it gets too heavy, just think of the kitty. Okay. Uneducated. What about uneducated?
A lot of educated people on the streets.
Yeah, I've met a lot of master's and PhD students on the street. No, I'm just kidding. But that automatically education would lead to, you know, being off the streets if we just put someone in some sort of vocational school or whatnot. I do encounter a lot of people who have been in cycles of abuse and have not attained their education. But that's, I wouldn't say it's because they're uneducated. I'd probably say that it's because they're suffering from abuse and or mental illness and. And then it's led to them not getting an education. And I wouldn't directly correlate that. And I know a lot of uneducated people who do quite well financially. So, okay, well, they choose it, a lifestyle choice. How many of you thought about where you were going to defecate today? Like, put a lot of thought into it.
I did go up the hill.
You did go up the hill, and you thought maybe Koinonia, yeah. Okay, why I ask is being homeless is a full-time job. If you've ever really been like stuck downtown Seattle and like just really gotta go, like places aren't set up to serve you anymore unless you buy something. So you could go pee for the price of a cup of coffee at some snooty coffee shop in downtown Seattle, but what if you're only getting, you know, $20 a day? You can't always go in to a public restroom and wash. I mean, during the winter we get a shower every other day, but where do you do that if you're homeless? I mean, where are you going to get your next meal if the food bank is on one side and then where you're going to sleep is on the other side? So the idea that they choose this lifestyle because it's easy, because it's convenient, is very much a misnomer. It is a full-time job meeting your basic needs when you're on the streets. Really, I mean, how would you like, every time, let's say you got sick and you had to think about how you're going to get into a bathroom. I mean, that, just there, you had me at bathroom, not to mention how, where you're going to sleep that night, who's going to watch your stuff, you know, who, where you're going to go for food. Now, have I met some of the stereotypes of people I think were choosing the lifestyle? Yeah, but I've met thousands of homeless people in downtown Seattle, and we're talking maybe about 10, where I've like, okay, well, you're that stereotype, but that is by far, it's more of a statistical outlier than an actual something that I've encountered amongst adults in downtown Seattle. Scammers. Anyone?
Let's see, when my dad always say, well, how come they've always got enough money for cigarettes?
It's a powerful addiction. I'll tell you a story about a scammer that this guy was really dedicated, and again, this is way statistical outlier, this isn't a, but just the idea of that you're just gonna, it's easy just to scam, is this guy pretended he was in a wheelchair for 2 years, pretended that he was, you know, mobility impaired, and he got denied his Social Security after 2 years of faking that he was in a wheelchair, and he's still in the shelter. So there's a scammer that didn't work, but that was one I saw try. Usually when they get to me, that they're way beyond the scammers. Can anyone think of a scam that you can pull that would lead to a comfortable lifestyle outside of maybe politics or something? Anyone?
It's not as easy to think of it. Well, for me, I don't have good homeless examples, but there's that sort of low income. You hear this argument a lot of, well, you stay on welfare because it's easier. I mean, there are certain things that if you are in the system, not as a homeless person necessarily, you can get government or other kinds of aid. And so using that as a scam, you hear that argument a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Not as much homelessness, but...
Yeah, I mean, the government does penalize you for not for getting a job, more for having worked in the past. The way they work their benefits, the normal benefit would be like 721 that you would get if you're just disabled. But if you work, you get, I think it's 1122 or something like that. But you have to pay
for all your food, and you got to pay for daycare, and you got to pay for all the other stuff.
And you have to pay the difference between the two for your medication. So in reality, everyone's getting 721 a month because you have to pay out of pocket for any medication that you need. And usually if you're disabled, you have to pay for meds too. So the idea that it's the easy way out, I still have yet to believe that.
Did you watch that video not too long ago about the gal that finally got a job, but then she found out she couldn't make it with the job? What was that video?
It was about hunger in America.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that once she had the job, she was worse off.
Because she had money, but she didn't have any services, and so paying for the services cost her more than she had.
Yeah, the system is broken, and again, that's probably bigger than we have time.
And yet, the statistics are that most people on welfare use it as a stepping stone and go on, even though this is true.
Yeah.
Most people don't just scam the system.
And most of the people that I've encountered who have been on my caseload and who've been living in the project that I help manage, a reasonable goal for them is that they would maybe volunteer somewhere someday.
What's the name of the organization or the hotel?
I work for the Downtown Emergency Service Center. It's in downtown Seattle, right across from the courthouse, which seems to be where you buy drugs in most places in America. It's really quite ironic.
What's the name of the old hotel?
The Morrison.
There's that one downtown that's got a church in the bottom, and then right next door is one of those places we talk about later.
Okay.
There's an alarm going off
Arnia.
Convenient. Okay, and one of my personal favorites, They Don't Know Jesus. Anyone want to tackle that?
Yeah. Alan, we're done digging.
Okay.
Anyone?
Well, Jesus wants us to be rich. So if you don't know and pray to Jesus properly, that's why you're not rich.
Yeah. There's
it's kind of backwards, isn't it?
There is kind of a non-Christian friend wanted me to bring this up, especially because there is kind of an undercurrent of default, not so much in progressive hippie Holden, but out there that someone who, if they just knew Jesus, they would get their lives together and be prosperous like Jesus wants us to be, and that people would be poor because of some sort of moral failing. I've encountered it. I don't necessarily like the model to where someone would have to listen to a sermon before they get fed. I actually think it should be the other way around. But it does exist. It is a model that is being used to this day. I'm not going to throw it all out and say that it's completely and totally wrong. I choose to work in a system that's unconditional acceptance of a person where they're at, as opposed to putting a barrier and making Jesus some sort of gatekeeper. Well, I guess theologians aside, you know what I'm trying to say.
The other side of that is that a lot of the people on the street do know Jesus.
Yeah, they're some of the most over-evangelized group of people that I've ever met.
Way too well.
Yeah, it's really great because they're very gentle with the very, very enthusiastic and well-meaning people who come downtown. They'll sit there and people that, were just in a fight for, because they wanted to call the police because someone stole their crack pipe. And then of all the Christians come around and they're, amen, just totally, it's really, they know how to work that system for sure.
Behavioral psychology is what that is.
Yeah. So we have some stereotypes here, and I'm saying we need to move along. So I wanted to transition into kind of what I want you to kind of take away from this. That you would kind of look at people who are homeless kind of with an informed compassion, and then not act to alleviate that out of some sort of sense of guilt, but just because it's the right thing to do as they're human beings who are in need. And that you would have an idea or some sort of understanding of the term harm reduction. And I'll go over that in a bit. And that you might, I want to try here if we can work using some scenarios of harm reduction in little tiny groups here. And then that this conversation would continue, because there's no way that we can like solve homelessness in this, but to be asking yourself and talking about it and thinking about it, praying about it, ruminating on it, however you want to, you know, meditating on it, just to, that this is a problem that we're confronted with as a society, and for too long I think we've been putting our head in the sand. So, okay, so I want to start talking a little bit about harm reduction and that how it fits within Housing First, and I wanted to tell you a story about a client of mine named Crystal. Crystal was schizophrenic, and she heard voices, very abused as a child. I suspect she also had fetal alcohol syndrome, or spectrum disorder now. She was very, very friendly. When I first started working with her, Crystal was walking into traffic, talked about killing herself all the time, almost a daily experience with her was trying to have some sort of suicide talk with her, and then sometimes that not working and having to call EMS and SPD to come and detain her, send her to the hospital to try to add some compensation to her, send her back there again. So when I got her, she was like this. And she slowly started to open up, started to trust me. And I was probably one of maybe two or three men in her life that was not trying to have sex with her or abuse her for my needs. She was still pretty tormented and felt a lot of guilt about her life. She felt very guilty for prostituting and felt a lot of religious guilt around it, and often wanted to talk about the Bible and prostitution and sex, because she was, this is the only way she knew how to feed her need for crack, was to offer sex or fellatio in the alley to meet those needs, because crack cocaine isn't like, well, if I have $20 worth of crack, well, that's enough to get me through this. There's not enough money for crack. It's always sent. The high lasts about 2 or 3 minutes, and you want it again. So there is no such thing as enough money. But in working with her and trying to add some stability, we were able to get her to the doctor. We're able to, you know, and I've have asked me some other time about taking Crystal to the doctor. But she started to trust me more and more with some of her life choices, just because I was a constant presence in her life and always seeking how she could, you know, she would come to me like, should I get beer or heroin today? And what do you think I told her to do? Yeah, no, I said absolutely not. Neither, because both of them are wrong. No, so we talk about the beer and how to manage that. So every little day making those little decisions, and she wanted me to be the one that she got pregnant, and she wanted me to be the one who took her to the abortion clinic, and I did that for her, something that we wouldn't have been able to get her into the clinic before. Wherever you stand on that, this was her choice, wasn't mine. But she slowly but surely wanted people in her life, and she was really cute with it, because she didn't really know like a love language or like what affection was or what to tell people, you know, like, thank you for helping me today. So what she knew was sex. So she made a big point of offering me a blowjob just about anywhere there were people, and she knew that it would get me. We'll edit that later. But after she knew it was spectacularly inappropriate, she would just do it just to hear me say, Crystal, that is spectacularly inappropriate, and you cannot offer to blow your case manager. But this, it said something about her, that this was what she knew as like, oh, I am so happy, I am so grateful for you for looking out for me. This is the only way I could do it. So, Crystal was also still tormented and she did not like her lifestyle, and things were not moving fast enough for her. And the only way that she saw that she could alleviate her suffering was to go to jail. And this was a really sad thing. We tried really hard to bring some stability to Crystal's life. And she ended up setting her room on fire. And she got her wish. She went to jail, and then she went to Western State for a while. Unfortunately, with an arson thing, that she is now pretty much banned from any housing facility in Seattle. And she is homeless again, which is... It really breaks my heart. But we were able to keep her stable for many years, something that her trajectory was going straight to the gutter really fast. We're trying harm reduction. Maybe some would say it didn't work. I think that there was some sort of foundation built myself. I have to believe that anyway. Next, I want to tell you about Joe. Joe was the closest thing that I could think of some sort of angel that you could possibly imagine. But Joe was feral when we got him. He was literally living in the bushes and scared of light. He would flinch when you talked at him.
How old is he?
In his 50s. So we got him into housing, and he... was fecally and urinary incontinent. He wore 20 layers, like a lot of people with schizophrenia do, just weren't able to regulate the heat and everything. And I saw him once a day when he came and took his medications, and we'd always make a big point. Hey, Joe, how's it going? Fine. You know, you thought that, you know, if you farted, he would probably just explode because he was just so wound up and tight. But after several years of being in supportive housing, of giving that opportunity, I mean, this person didn't live like Martha Stewart. He lived in basically a hovel full of stuff that he just collected off the streets. So he wasn't living like this showcase kind of existence in supportive housing. But slowly but surely, he started to transform. And I just about fell out of my seat years after this. He was singing karaoke at an open mic at the housing facility, and there was not a dry eye in that audience. He got really involved with the church, really involved. He would need us to box up his meds and his diapers and everything, so he'd have this big bag of diapers and medications and go off to hang out with the norms at their church. And it was just so amazing, and he would come and talk about what they did at the church camp and whatnot. And he's someone who really, really thrived in that environment of just having people just meet him right where he's at and care for him. I'm going to say love him just for who he is, and then keep pushing him to attain just a little bit higher level of self-sufficiency. Unfortunately, Joe has passed away. Me and a coworker found him on a welfare check, and he had just died, and he'd been dead too long to resuscitate. But at his funeral, it was at the Plymouth congregation in downtown Seattle. Anyone know that? I'm not going to say that the sanctuary was full, but there was a lot of people who were able to experience Joe, and this was a guy who, you know, 7 years earlier was living in the bushes, and all of a sudden he's filled out a church of people, brothers and sisters who came around him, and many, many hardened, grizzled social workers who despise everything about religion were at that church crying and then celebrating Joe's life. Okay, so harm reduction. Has anyone heard the term before? No one. Okay, the nurse in the back. Oh, but we just talked about it. I gave you the
Well, I knew before.
Okay. What it started with is with heroin addicts and the idea of just giving them clean rigs and whatnot to be able to shoot. So there, dirty needles spread a lot of different things. Hep C, AIDS, necrotizing fasciitis, you name it. Heroin is not a very clean substance, so it, just in itself, it's a salt, so it destroys veins and whatnot. But anything that you have in you is going to be in the spoon, in the needle, in the syringe. Just about everything that touches heroin is going to go into your body. So the idea, well, we want to stop Hep C, we want to stop AIDS, we want to stop this, we want to stop that. Okay, well, they could stop heroin, or, you know, we could provide clean rigs for them. No questions asked. If here, you bring in your old rig, we'll hand you a new setup. You bring in 10, we'll give you 10 back. And we saw it really, you know, decline a lot of the Hep C rates and a lot of the necrotizing fasciitis and AIDS and whatnot. We're all kind of diminished because of this idea. So we extrapolated that out and said, okay, it would be great if people were completely sober. It would be great if people made great life decisions all the time. I don't know about you, but I can't even make great life decisions all the time. So the idea that someone who's suffering under an addiction, like a crippling addiction, and dealing with homelessness, and that they're just going to cut this out under just the strength of their own willpower, it happens, and it's a beautiful thing when it happens. But there are steps that you can do in between. So if someone is drinking a lot of alcohol, we could try to monitor the amount of alcohol that they're drinking. You know, if someone would just drink it all right away, why don't we, you know, we'll choose beer instead of a short of whatever the cheapest whiskey is. We'll try beer, and then they could come get it every couple hours from us. And then so they'll drink less. I mean, so you could kind of extrapolate that out to, you know, different things. And I'm going to do a quick little scenario here to see if how we could start thinking of how we could make things just a little bit better. Okay, so we'll start with an easy one. And I guess, like, just within a little group here, you know, just turn around. If you don't like the people behind you, maybe look for the people in front. Okay, so we'll start with an easy one. And apologize about we're gonna venture in that again, because this was one of my favorite harm reduction stories. Is we'll call him Charles. Charles was in the shelter, and in the shelter, he could not stop masturbating. He would masturbate in the men's room, much to the displeasure of people trying to do other things in the men's room, and he would masturbate on the mats. Okay, so we had these other bathrooms, which for people who had wheelchairs and whatnot. So what do we do? How do we, you know, do we let him use the wheelchair restroom so he could do his thing, or do we just kick him out in the shelter? Mind you, our job is to try to house people. So talk amongst yourselves, see if you could come up with a solution. Okay. Like I said, this was an easy one.
Yeah.
What do we do? What do we do for Charles?
Give him a bathroom.
Let him use the bathroom and do his thing so we could keep him housed, so we could keep him in the shelter. Because you don't want him to be homeless. Would we rather he not do that in public? Yeah. As someone who worked in that environment, I've seen enough of that to last me a lifetime. But, yes, we used the treatment bathroom, and he was fine. He was no longer a problem in the shelter. Okay. Next one. Colin does not want to talk to you about his goals or anything to make his life better. He simply says, you need to give me all the money that I have coming to me, and I want a week worth of meds, or I'm going to kill myself. What do you do?
Yeah.
Okay. What do we got? The back group here, what did you guys come up with?
We wanted to talk about the suicide thing, like what's your plan? And
okay.
Kind of get to understand that before we give meds and money, just to kind of say, so tell us about that.
Okay. Assessing risk is definitely a great place to start, and even here, you know, it's important to ask people if they have a plan. What about you guys up front here?
We didn't come up with anything.
Didn't come up with anything?
I just suggested give it to him, the money and the meds, and he's not going to talk to you anyway, it sounds like, about any plans or anything else. And then if he runs through everything in a couple of days, he just has to wait.
Mm-hmm.
The next week. But
okay. Allie?
Ellen suggested making sure that he's in a safe environment being watched, mm-hmm. but giving him what he asks for and what he needs on like a day by day basis instead of for the whole week.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of if that's gonna keep happening, just keep needing it. But yeah, that's all I got.
Yep.
That's what we were at too.
Bill, what'd you come up with?
I think Carol said came up with the idea of just on a day to day basis. Yeah. Rationing.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Colin was my client, and do you guys want to know what I did?
Yeah.
Okay. Colin often tried to shock me with things, like he would say it was because I'm not going to give his money because he's gay, because he, you know, I hate him, this, that, and the other thing. I didn't give him his money, and I didn't dare him to kill himself, but I also did not want to reinforce a negative kind of, you come in, you tell me you're going to kill yourself, and you get what you want. Because using suicide, I mean, we have a joke, I'm sorry, we shouldn't say we joke about it, but it was like, if you don't pass me the chips, I'm going to kill myself. Because like, it really became like his go-to answer for everything.
Right.
So, and also the meds that we were giving him could be used to hurt himself as well. So, I believe he was getting Seroquel, so I can't remember if he would take all of it. Yeah. But we did the plan, and then I ended up calling the police saying this guy's going to kill himself in my lobby, so we need to come deal with him. So I ended up evaluating him in the hospital later that day. So given 100 different times, maybe 10 of them I might have just given him all his money, depending on my patient's level, I guess. So. Do you guys want a hard one? Well, I have to respect that you guys have lunch and your tummy's growling. I could stay longer and we could work through some of this stuff. Like I said, 45 minutes was really optimistic for me to get through this. I feel like we've got through about...
I'd like to have another session like this.
Yeah,
do it again.
Do it again?
Yeah.
Zumba?
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Why don't we... I could kind of put a lid on this. Is everyone okay with that? And then maybe we could readdress some of this. And then if people need to go, go ahead and take off. I have a big...
We have 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. If anyone has any questions, we didn't get to the end of my, what I thought was a very modest syllabus. Cindy, I'm sorry. Questions? Any?
Yeah, so kind of a question regarding... And the underlying ethic that's driving this this work of harm reduction, or in your experience, you've given us these different scenarios where, from one perspective, people are asking for a thing. You know, in this last example, an individual is asking for something that may or may not be his right to ask for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm kind of wondering the underlying ethic that drives your thought process there of, one, am I here to, under the premise of harm reduction, provide housing in that extent? Or am I also here to kind of make those deals with somebody? If an individual is, you know, because I guess the other example I'm coming up with is if one of you asks me for something that is yours, what is my role in kind of netting that out? Recognizing there's some differences here, but I just wonder... Your experience, what's this underlying ethic that you come back to help make those decisions?
There's lots of bargaining. There's lots of like de-escalating of behavior. There's lots of, well, if you choose A, B will happen. If you choose, you know. I felt that my role primarily in the overall ethic of what I was doing as a case manager was to be more concerned about the long term. Like, I could take little individual snapshots of someone's daily existence, and they could be pretty awful, but the overall trajectory, the overall mosaic of it can be an upward kind of continuum. So I wasn't always thinking of the immediate need. I was thinking, okay, well, what is this going to teach him right now if I give in and do this? And my job isn't necessarily to be liked all the time either. And generally, their first impulses have led them to having a case manager like me in the first place. So managing their lives and doing what they want has led them, a lot of them, to have acquired the skills to be my client at this point. But really, it was always trajectory. It was always long-term for me whenever possible. There are incidents in the moment where I have to deal with something that's very acute. But generally, I was always looking to at least till tomorrow.
So success is they're living in a housing unit, mm-hmm. and they're... What, stable would be a word I want to use.
Successful housing looks different for everyone.
Right.
So you living in a place successfully looks a lot different than Bill living in a place successfully or one of my clients, you know.
But going back to Andrew's question, to me, it's more like parenting than what we would do with each other. These are people who didn't successfully grow up. And, you know, what you're...
Or they've
doing
learned a
really
lot of negative skills
like
over the... I mean,
parenting.
The street isn't always the best teacher for acquiring, you know, the skills that we all celebrate, you know. The survival skills that people are picking up. And survival skills don't always make great company with, you know, at the table that are, you know, for people can handle. This is a good question, though. It is one that I find that you have to keep wrestling with. I never really made it as a social worker saying, like, I finally have all this in my pocket. I understand where it intersects theologically, socially, anthropologically. It was something that I kept shifting around. And maybe that's why I lasted 10 years, or maybe I'm just a masochist. I don't know. But I think it's something to constantly be asking yourself.
Can I know where some people are going to take
it. Yeah, and again, if you leave, you're not going to hurt my feelings. You know, trust me.
So I've never gone like on a mission trip, but I sometimes really am turned off by the language around things like that, where people are going to help someone,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the language that I've come to be drawn to is a company to mm-hmm. walk with. And I feel like the parenting thing isn't good to me either. It's like, ooh, I don't know if people need my help. You know, it kind of turns me off that I want them to be able to just be who they are and go there and be a companion in that spot, and hopefully by having a companion that the walk can go somewhere that maybe isn't
mm-hmm.
nearer to death. But, you know, I don't know how that resonates with you.
It takes a lot more work, and it doesn't make as cool a slideshow later.
Yeah.
But you might not be able to convert the masses, but I know I have changed lives. And it, you know, I sometimes said, like, my greatest act of compassion some days is just showing up to work.
Yeah. Well, like the story you were sharing about the woman that didn't know how to think, but mm-hmm. I feel like you were a companion. You were mm-hmm. a presence in her life that was walking alongside.
Yeah, I saw her every day.
Her crazy life.
Every day, multiple times a day.
And somehow you being in that spot is what she was drawn to.
Yeah.
And able to open up to,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to...
I used to get the greatest calls from her from the psych hospital. Like, it was just warmed my heart. She'd call and check in on me. Again, I'm sorry. Sorry first to Cindy, because she warned me about this and fired. Sorry that I wasn't able to... 45 minutes is just not long enough to tackle any of this. Please, I love this topic and would... Any questions that you have, I'd love to entertain them. Whether I have the answer or not is... highly unlikely, but
Anyway, thank you for coming. I'm sorry.